You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The three claimants have been awarded total damages of in excess of $50 billion. This is, by a multiple of more than 20, the largest arbitration award ever.
Xenia Wickett from Chatham House and Ivor Gaber from City University will join me to discuss the day's top stories, including that $50 billion judgment against Russia in The Hague, the latest from Gaza, the actually worsening war in Syria, and what Barack Obama has learned about the world and vice versa in the 10 years since his famous DNC keynote speech. We'll also have an excerpt from the new edition of Monocle's summer newspaper, Mediterraneo, an exclusive mystery story by Anne Zarudi.
He carried the scent of the mountains on his clothes, and his breath stank of the ouzo he'd been drinking. His dog, a skinny pointer, had followed him into the kitchen and was sniffing at the dirty saucer where the cats ate.
Plus, we'll check in with our man in Belgrade and review the latest exhibitions in New York. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. Lots coming up then in the next hour here on Midori House, but ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
An explosion in a public garden in the Beach refugee camp in northern Gaza has killed 10 people today, 8 of them children, according to medics, during a relative lull in fighting during the Muslim Eid holiday. Locals later blamed the blast on an Israeli airstrike, but Israel denied responsibility, saying it was a misfire by a rocket launched by Hamas militants. Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza have been locked in 3 weeks of fighting, which has already killed 1,049 people in Gaza, mostly civilians. Some 43 Israeli soldiers have died, along with 3 civilians killed by projectiles within Israel. Well, Cecily Goeng from the Red Cross says it's proving hard to reach those most in need of help inside Gaza.
It's difficult to access those in need when the fighting is taking place. There's a lot of fighting sometimes. So for people to be able to go to places where are safer within the strip, and for us to go to those places and to coordinate both with Hamas authorities and the Israeli authorities, sometimes it takes time and it's very frustrating for us.
Meanwhile, more than 5,000 people marched through Brussels protesting against Israel's military offensive in Gaza. Demonstrators say they wanted to tell people there they weren't alone.
You are not alone. All the world is now demonstrating against the crimes of Israel. You can see now thousands of people are joining us. Thousands of people know already that Israel is not a state of democracy. It's a state of crimes and killing the children.
Other news now, the Hague's arbitration court ruled today that Russia must pay a group of shareholders in oil giant Yukos $51.6 billion for expropriating its assets. The arbitration panel in the Netherlands said it had awarded shareholders in the GML group just under half of their $114 billion US dollar claim, going some way to covering the money they lost when the Kremlin seized Yukos, once controlled by Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Fighting forced international experts to abandon plans for a second day running to get to the site in eastern Ukraine, where a downed Malaysian airliner crashed to conduct their investigation. Ukraine officials say 2 rebel-held towns have been recaptured, and attempts were being made to take a village Kiev says was near the launch site of the surface-to-air missile that shot down Malaysia Airlines MH17 with the loss of all 298 on board. Andrew Colvin is a commissioner for national security at the Australian Federal Police.
There remains a possibility that we won't get there in the near future. I don't want to consider the fact that we may never get to that site. I think from a victims and families perspective, the Australian government and the AFP will continue to do everything we can to get onto that site.
A huge fuel depot in Libya's capital burnt out of control on Monday, set ablaze in fighting between rival militias that has driven the country to chaos 3 years after the NATO-backed revolt that toppled Muammar Gaddafi. Combat over control of the nearby airport forced firefighters to withdraw, abandoning their attempts to extinguish the blaze ignited by a missile strike that hit millions of litres of fuel. Western countries have urged their nationals to leave, shut their embassies and pulled diplomats out after 2 weeks of clashes among rival factions. Of former rebels killed nearly 160 people in Tripoli and the eastern city of Benghazi. And finally, in the United States, a street performer dressed as Spider-Man in New York City's Times Square was arrested after punching a police officer who scolded him for demanding more money from a couple he had posed with for a picture. The incident began when Junior Bishop, who's 25, was overheard by a police officer refusing a $1 bill from a woman with whom he'd taken a picture, insisting instead on a larger denomination. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. A tangled web we weave. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me in the studio with their take on the news is Xenia Wickett, US Project Director at Chatham House, and Ivor Gaber, Professor of Political Journalism at City University. Welcome both. We will start with Russia. While the world continues to squabble about how or if to sanction Russia for arming Ukrainian hillbillies with the kind of equipment that can shoot down airliners, a Dutch court has imposed an expensive punishment for an earlier misdemeanor. The Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague has ordered Russia to pay a few rubles short of £30 billion in damages to shareholders in the defunct Russian oil company Yukos. Xenia, I'll start with you. The timing here is kind of exquisite, isn't it?
It is exquisite, but I don't think, I mean, first of all, the two aren't related,
clearly,
except in some broader sense that, you know, Russia is acting in ways that we don't consider to be international norms. The other thing to remember is, before we get too enthusiastic, even though there is no formal appeals process, Russia won't pay this money in any way close to that number.
They might find it would be a surprise, all things considered.
It would be stunning. So, I mean, I think, you know, yes, but this is really, one should see this really just as a yet one more indication, perhaps, that this is not a new Russia we're seeing. There's a long-term tendency to ignore international norms when they don't meet the interests of the Putin government.
This case, of course, pertains to the closing down of Yukos and the imprisoning of its then CEO, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, which was widely perceived as having been a politically driven stunt by Vladimir Putin. Ivor, it's, as Xenia points out, there is next to zero chance that Russia is going to settle this debt. But the ruling was altogether damning. It said Russian courts bent to the will of Russian executive authorities to bankrupt Yukos, assign its assets to a state-controlled company, and incarcerate a man who gave signs of becoming a political competitor. That paints a pretty damning picture of the Kremlin, does it not?
Well, it depends where you're standing. President Putin would think just perfect. I do think it has laid bare in a very vivid way the reality of Russia today, which is unfortunately not much different from the reality of Russia before the fall of the Berlin Wall. There is a very strong tradition in Russia of the authorities, be that the Kremlin, the courts, the police, and so forth, moving, singing to one song. And I think we've yet to see any a really democratic Russia. I mean, I don't know whether Khodorkovsky would have been the start of that process, but, you know, the Russian oligarchs, many of them, Berezovsky, the late Boris Berezovsky, shouted loudly about democracy, human rights, but one has a sneaking suspicion that had they got to power, or if they get to power, they might follow in the traditions of Putin. So it's not a democracy, and perhaps we can't judge it by the standards of democracy, but we can judge it by the norms of international relations. And this is a binding agreement that the international community, quote, requires to be fulfilled. Whether it will be, of course, as Zeina says, is pretty unlikely.
Zeina, as you do say, that the chances of Russia paying this £30 billion or even £30 have to be perceived as remote. That being the case, does this teach us anything about the current attempts to figure out a way to sanction Russia over MH17? If Russia has determined to exist completely outside international norms, is there even any point in trying to punish it?
So this is what's interesting. I was having a conversation on a similar topic last week, and the argument that was being made to me by an American was that the way that Russia is being punished today, yes, we're finding it very, very hard to impose any significant sanctions on Russia or Russian entities at the moment, because the Europeans care deeply about their markets and about energy. And so, various different European countries to greater or lesser extent. So it's very, very hard to do. But the way that Russia is being punished is the markets are punishing Russia. So the argument is essentially people are not going to invest in Russia. They're not going to put, until there's a solid rule of law, until there's a decrease in corruption, until people know that their investments will be honoured, people are going to stop investing, they're going to stop putting money in, they're going to stop building. That will have a huge impact on Russia's economy over the long term. Now, the problem is relatively speaking, that's a slow, it's going to take time for that to come to effect. Whereas what Russia's doing is very immediate at the moment in Ukraine. And so how we connect these short-term immediate actions in Ukraine with what is a long-term but slow and potentially very painful process in Russia is very, very hard to do. But that's essentially what the policymakers need to do, is to connect the short-term pain with long-term pain and therefore change behaviour if that is possible in that way.
It's a lovely thought, really, as it always is, the thought that the market will sort things out. And indeed, in fairness, a big part of the reason why the city we're sitting in has become such an expensive one to live in is that Russians who have made money by fair means or foul would rather invest it in Britain than Russia.
Yes, but it's a great idea, but the market also dictates that you don't do anything to damage yourself, and Britain is dragging its feet on Russian sanctions because Britain will be hit very hard because of the City of London. So there is self-interest. And of course, we've also got BP, which is still mostly British-owned, still with heavy investments. In fact, it would be clobbered by this judgment if it was carried out. So I think there's certain ambiguity, even as far as the Prime Minister David Cameron not backing his deputy on taking the World Cup. I mean, that's going a bit far, I have to say, as a football fan, taking the 2018 World Cup away from Russia. So we speak loud, but I'm not sure we carry a big gun, because we don't want to end up pointing at ourselves. And I think the City of London would be damaged by taking too strong an action against Russia, unfortunately.
One final thought, and one brief final thought on this from each of you. Mikhail Khodorkovsky has today issued a statement saying, obviously, he welcomes this judgment. He's issued this on his website. Khodorkovsky was pardoned in December. He's now in Switzerland. Said website, it is hard to avoid noticing, is extremely presidential looking. Does he still fancy his chances?
Go ahead.
I can give you an authoritative I don't know, because the one thing that presidential candidates who are serious don't do is declare themselves presidential candidates. I have a little knowledge of Russian oligarchs getting involved in politics. I had a period of working, how can I put it, alongside Boris Berezovsky. Of course, by the time he was in London, he was very overt in his politics, but certainly my impression of coming across one or two of these oligarchs is they play their cards so close to their chest that you can see them through their back, if you like to mix my biological metaphors. I don't know. I don't think he's declared, but clearly he was a leading figure when he was arrested. It's interesting to speculate, just to end and throw the ball to Zeina, because I don't know the answer. Why did Putin release him?
So I'm not going to answer that question, although, not least because that would make for a lot much longer conversation. The thing I would perhaps say is the question isn't, is he going to run? The question is, even if he were to run or somebody else were to run, do they have any chance of succeeding? And in today's world, I think the answer is no, unless you are friend, ally, supporter of Putin, you don't have a chance.
And just to add a PS, he is Jewish and there's still a strong vein of anti-Semitism running through Russia. And I think he wouldn't stand a chance because of that.
OK, well, we shall proceed now to Gaza, or rather return now to Gaza, where fighting between Israel's defence forces and Hamas appears to be continuing into a fourth week. More than 1,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians, are dead, along with 43 Israeli soldiers and 3 civilians, with 4 more Israelis killed in a mortar attack this afternoon. Calls for ceasefires have been ignored and or rejected by both sides, and in the last half an hour, Israel has told people to evacuate several neighbourhoods in Gaza City. Ivor, I'll start with you first. John Kerry floated a ceasefire plan late last week. Why didn't it stick?
Well, I think there is the problem now that has developed under Obama that the Israeli, the relations between Netanyahu and Obama are clearly not good. And I suspect it might have been the Israeli government not wanting to give any credit to the US. The relations between the two, despite the Americans' automatic support for Israel in most situations. I think that's become a tense relationship, and perhaps the Israelis were reluctant to let the Americans have any credit.
Xenia, how bad are Israeli-US relations? As Ivor points out, there is a reflexive support for Israel, and I suspect quite genuine on both sides of the House in the United States. But it's clear that Obama and Netanyahu dislike each other personally, and the two countries do appear to be not getting on at all well at the moment.
They do. There was a very interesting piece in the New York Times last week that essentially had looked at polling, I think it was Pew polling, on support for Israel in the US and support for Israel in many European countries, and there's just a huge difference between how Americans on the street, this is not just the elites in Washington and New York, but Americans on the street see support for Israel as being very, very fundamental. A majority very much see support for Israel over the support for the Palestinians, where that's reversed in Europe. And so there is this kind of instinctual support. At the same time, you know, as Ivor said, the relations between the US and Israel has worsened considerably under the Obama administration. In part, that's probably a result of what was a fairly strong position by the Obama administration at the beginning of his first term, where he essentially said, no more building settlements, none at all. And then about 18 months into the first term, 2 years into the first term, there was a backtracking by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and a much softer approach. But Obama has tried to take a much stronger approach. On the other hand, you do have to remember, you know, look at the UN vote just last week. The only country who actually vetoes and supports Israel is the United States. So the Israelis may not like America. They may not support America. They may not think that America is taking a fair position, whether it's led by Kerry or led by Obama. But they still are the only international kind of close friend who is reliable at the moment.
The Israeli media's reporting of this has been fairly extraordinary by the standards of the Israeli media. Haaretz called John Kerry a nebbish, which is not a compliment, we should be clear. The Times of Israel went so far to accuse him of a betrayal. Ivor, is this just the Israeli media doing as medias do in times of war and falling in behind the government and the nation? Or is there a genuine schism developing here?
I don't think. I think there's a different explanation. Israel has military service, compulsory military service.
Indeed.
Most male journalists, no, and female journalists actually, it's both sexes or genders, have served in the military. I think that makes them very, apart from obvious patriotism and rockets landing in Tel Aviv where they're working, I think once you've been in the army and you've been there and you maybe, you know you're going there to do reservist duty shortly, I think it makes it very difficult to be a dispassionate observer. I think the Israeli media in times of peace is quite a lively oppositional. But I think they come into line with the population. I visit Israel fairly frequently, and one can have reasonable discussions when the rockets aren't coming over. As soon as Israel is attacked, the country coheres and, you know, we are one and never again. Nobody's going to rub our noses in it. And I think it makes for this sort of media coverage. I think ordinary Israelis still regard America as their most important friend, ally. I think there was scepticism about Obama in Israel, this nonsense about him being a secret Muslim and stuff played. Netanyahu and the right-wing government didn't do anything to block it. So there might be a little bit of anti-Obamaism, but I think overall there's a very strong sense that we America and us sink or swim together.
Okay, well, we shall take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, as well as Xenia Wickett and Ivor Gaber. When we return, we'll be looking at Syria and also assessing what Barack Obama has learned about the practical realities of politics since announcing himself in such grand style 10 years ago.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Xenia Wickett from Chatham House and Ivor Gaber from City University. We'll turn now to Syria, which is not something the world has been doing much of while understandably preoccupied these last couple of weeks. While attention has been focused on eastern Ukraine and Gaza, Syria's interminable civil war has escalated to its bloodiest heights yet. By some estimates, 700 people died in fighting just around Homs on Thursday and Friday last week. Xenia, I'll ask you first, have we completely passed the point at which any meaningful intervention is likely or even possible?
No, I don't think so. I mean, what worries me when people talk about Syria is they look at this current status quo and it's very short-termish. The question I have, and I repeat regularly with government officials, be they American, British or otherwise, is, you know, look out 3 years. What are the 2-3 scenarios, the good, the bad and the ugly for Syria? Can we live with any of them? And if the answer is no, and I suspect in many cases the answer is no,
because,
then what,
because good is going to be a very relative proposition.
Because good,
it?
You know, the good scenario is it doesn't get worse than it is today. You know, the bad scenario and the ugly scenarios are that the instability, that the violence, as we've already seen, has not even crept, has launched itself into Iraq, continues to launch itself into Lebanon, Jordan, some of the other neighbors. And so you kind of say, well, the good is no better than it is today, possibly. The bad is really ugly. Can we live with that? And if we can't live with that, what can we do? Are there things that we can still do? Yes. Would they have been easier to do a year ago or 2 years ago? Absolutely. But are they easier to do now than in a year from now? Almost certainly.
There's been some suggestion, at least, Ivor, by Obama's apologists and boosters that the MH17 incident vindicates his decision not to arm the rebels with, extremely high-octane surface-to-air equipment. I mean, he was also always in the invidious position that trying to get the American people excited about intervening in an Arab civil war was always going to be a tough sell. He's now looking for $500 million to arm and train some rebel elements. How do you even begin to decide who to equip?
Well, I think you can decide who you don't equip. I mean, that's an easier suggestion. And I think the rise of ISIS in all of the horrible reality has made it easier to say clearly we must focus on the Syrian opposite, the secular opposition, if we can, or the moderate Islamics, if they're still left, although I gather they've virtually disintegrated. I think he's between a rock and a hard place, frankly. Interesting link you make with MH17. I have to say that hadn't occurred to me, but I do think that the very deep vein that runs through this whole process is never again. Iraq is, and Afghanistan have been such a disaster in terms of America trying to go in and create democracies that understandably the US population are, to put it mildly, sceptical. So he's in a very difficult position. And I think it's the criticism of Obama. There was something in Melanie Phillips, one of our commentators, said the free world has no leadership. I think it's a very tough ask to, for an American president to try and sort out the mess in Syria because it is so complex.
The other thing I would say, I mean, you know, we default always to the United States, but the best operations, the best efforts are ones that are conducted supporting people on the ground, of which one, yes, one absolutely has to find the relatively speaking, the moderate voices, but also with some of the neighbours. Now, there's always challenges with the neighbours. Because they have their own interests, but this shouldn't be just about the United States. It has to be broader.
Well, while you're in an ideal world, that would be the UN. But we know there are big problems with the UN. But the I've just come back from working in Africa, and actually the AU, the African Union, have intervened quite effectively in a number of hotspots, Somalia and Mali, to name but two. And it's just a pity we can't actually replicate that at a global level.
Well, that would require the Arab League to actually behave in a coherent and disciplined fashion, and you could be waiting a while for that to happen.
Or the OIC.
Or indeed. But on the subject of Barack Obama, it was 10 years ago yesterday that the then state senator from Illinois gave the keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. His ostensible role that night was to encourage his fellow Americans to send John Kerry to the White House. Instead, he prompted a dramatic shortening of odds on the United States electing a black president.
In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too. Hope. Hope in the face of difficulty. Hope in the face of uncertainty. The audacity of hope.
Ivor Gaber, does that seem longer ago than 10 years to you?
Yeah, and his voice has changed, hasn't it? That was a great performance. I remember watching it live, shivers going up and down my spine. He caught that audience. Watching him the other night talking, whether it was about Ukraine or I think it was about Ukraine, he's lost that spark. I suppose, you know, it's a hard job in the White House. He's lost that spark. But that was inspirational. And a few months after that, I happened to bump into him. He was visiting, I was in Africa, in South Africa, in Soweto, and he was visiting the apartheid museum there. I won't go into the details. Except I said to the police, what's going on here? And they said, oh, there's some American with a funny name visiting. And I was going to say I shook his hand, but I think Barack likes to say he shook hands with Ivor Gaber. But the point of this story...
He talks of little else.
The point of this story is, I won't go into detail, but there was there's what we call in the business a money shot. There was a fantastic photo opportunity that hadn't been contrived. He just wandered into a situation and he suddenly spotted it, and he called the cameras over and produced, without a spin doctor, a brilliant shot. And I just said to the people I was with, that man's going far. He had it then.
I can remember being in Philadelphia the night he was elected president in 2008, which was an excellent night, and indeed subsequent couple of days out, as you might well imagine. Xenia, the skinny kid with the funny name 10 years ago, how do you think he's aged in that time?
He has a totally different role today. I mean, this is it. You know, we can sit there and we can say, has he changed? Is he better? Is he worse? But, you know, at the time, he was an up-and-comer. He was an unknown. The risk of him, you know, the risk was, the downside of him getting it wrong was so much less. But the upside of him taking a risk and getting it right and putting everything on the line was so much greater. You know, today he represents the United States. So you look at him today and yes, he looks older and he looks tired and he has, you know, I was about to say white flecks in his hair. That's being generous. But he's also the president of the United States with all of the responsibilities that comes with that. So you know, there is much less hope because actually, you know that these are really tough decisions and that the decisions you have to choose between are bad ones and worse ones rather than good ones and bad ones. You know, his hope, his desire, as he made clear in that speech, to work across the aisle has been blown out of the water. Now, is that his fault? Is it the Republicans' fault? It's probably a little bit of both. But that hope has clearly gone today. So I don't think we should judge him too unkindly for seeing a different person today and somebody without that enthusiasm and without that youth and without that energy.
How do you think history would judge him?
I think history, we will have to see. It's too, It's certainly too early to tell as to whether history judges him well or not.
And Ivor, just finally, how since that historic handshake with you in Soweto, how do you think he's done?
Well, I think Zaina knows what she's talking about. It's a tough ask. I think he has, nobody expected, I think, the opposition, Congress to become so paralysed. I think the US Constitution is not fit for purpose. I think, final point, his lack of experience as a junior senator from Illinois showed through his inability to manage a very hostile Congress. But whether anybody could manage it, I don't know.
Ivor Gaber and Zaina Wickett, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll speak to our correspondent in Belgrade. We will have an excerpt from the exclusive mystery story in the new issue of Mediterraneo, and we'll catch up on the latest exhibitions in New York. But before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. An explosion in a beach refugee camp in northern Gaza has killed 10 people today, 8 of them children, according to medics, during a relative lull in fighting during the Muslim Eid holiday. Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza have been locked in 3 weeks of fighting, which has already killed 1,049 people in Gaza, mostly civilians. The Hague's arbitration court has ruled today that Russia must pay a group of shareholders in oil giant Yukos $51.6 billion for expropriating its assets. Fighting has forced international experts to abandon plans for a second day running to get to the site in eastern Ukraine, where a downed Malaysian airliner crashed, to conduct their investigation. And a huge fuel depot in Libya's capital Tripoli burnt out of control on Monday, set ablaze in fighting between rival militias that has driven the country to chaos 3 years after the NATO-backed revolt that toppled the former leader Muammar Gaddafi. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, which makes it 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, it's the turn of our man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay. Guy, welcome to the show. I wanted to start with the latest update in, this is a peculiar story, even by the standards of the region, this persistent rumours that senior Kosovo Liberation Army members, now senior members of Kosovo's government, were trafficking internal organs in the 90s.
Yes, it's extremely bizarre, and it's one which really hasn't gone away over a period of about 15 years. And this is something which a few years ago, there was a report by the Council of Europe by a prosecutor called Dick Marty, which directly accused senior members of Kosovo's government, including Prime Minister Hashim Tachi, of being involved in this plot to murder ethnic Serbs during the conflict and then profit from the sale of their internal organs. Now, this has always been rubbished by Kosovo, for obvious reasons, one would have thought. But Clint Williamson, the US war crimes investigator, was appointed by the European Union to look into this and to settle the matter once and for all. And he's going to be making his report in Brussels on Tuesday morning.
And is there any suggestion of what's going to be in this report? Because this story, as you suggest, and you know as well as or better than most people, that the Balkans is one of the world's foremost producers of lurid conspiracy theories. But even by the standards of the region, this did sound like a stretcher. Are we going to be asked to believe that there might be something in it after all?
Well, the thing is that Clint Williamson has been visiting Belgrade and Pristina over the past couple of weeks. And actually, nobody knows, or at least nobody he's telling me that they know, even, you know, double, triple off the record, what's going to be in his report. And I believe that they don't know what's going to be in his report. And I think the only time we'll find out precisely what's going to be there is when he announces it in Brussels on Tuesday morning. What we have heard rumoured in some of the daily newspapers, both in Pristina and in Belgrade, is that they're going to confirm that organ trafficking did exist, but not at such a senior level as was suggested in the earlier Council of Europe report. But again, you're not going to be able to believe precisely what the details are until Mr. Williamson himself reveals them.
Well, moving along then, the world will be marking in the coming weeks the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. This is obviously an event which has greater resonance than in most places where you are. For Serbia especially, I think it's been kind of forgotten and underrated what an enduring trauma it was.
Enormous trauma. One in four of the population of Serbia died during the First World War. It was one of the worst hit countries by all means, and Belgrade found itself on the front line immediately. So Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia 100 years ago today, on the 28th of July. Overnight, it launched an attack on the city, because Austria-Hungary was only literally over the water from Belgrade in those days. Nowadays, it's the Belgrade suburb of Zemun over there. In those days, it was Austria-Hungary. And so they tried to launch an attack down the river. They were actually repulsed, much to their surprise, by a bunch of policemen and volunteers. And that set the course for the fate of Belgrade over the next few years. It was eventually sacked by Austro-Hungarian forces and their allies, but did fight back, but at enormous cost to the country.
And how is it being? How is this 100th anniversary being marked in Belgrade?
You know, it's very curious. A year ago, there were all these plans to have statues of Gavrilo Princip erected in Serbia, just as they'd been erected in the Serb parts of Bosnia. And that hasn't come through at all. It's been very, very low-key here. There was a small concert at Belgrade Fortress on Sunday. There's a session of government in the city of Niš today to mark the fact that the government fled there during the First World War for the safety of Niš, because Belgrade was too vulnerable. But other than that, there's been very little, and people have been saying, well, is this all to do with the fact that Serbia now is set on a path towards European Union membership and doesn't want to be, you know, poking its future fellow members in the eye by making a big deal of all of this? Nobody's really answering those questions, Andrew.
But do you get the feeling that the government might be trying to wind in the nationalist rhetoric a bit for that and indeed other reasons?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's quite correct. And I think, you know, the funny thing is, you know Serbia as well, Andrew, that the people here are never scared of glorying in a fantastic defeat. The national psyche is pretty much built on it. So you'd have thought that with the tragedy of the First World War in this country, the people really would be making quite something of it. But it's extremely striking that there's not a lot going on. And if any city had the right to make something of it, it would be Belgrade. This is where the first shots were fired in Europe. This was a city which was on the front line and occupied. And yet, going about your daily business in Belgrade today, you'd be hard-pushed to notice that this was the fact at all.
Well, we shall move along to fallout from a more recent conflict. The Oliver Ivanovich story, he was arrested 6 months ago. He's been held ever since. Where are we with this?
Now, this is Oliver Ivanovich, who was one of the senior ethnic Serb figures in North Kosovo, and considered by all and sundry to be very much a moderate figure. And he was arrested by the European Union police forces in Kosovo 6 months ago on suspicion of involvement in war crimes in the late 90s. And then there have been no charges ever since, but he's still in custody. And now Belgrade saying, well, it's 6 months. It's quite long enough for him to be in jail. Either charge him or let him go. And you really do wonder about the intervention of international forces. You've got Vojislav Sešelja, the Serb radical leader from the 1990s, who's been on trial in The Hague, but no result obtained for more than a decade. He's been in custody for more than a decade there. Now it seems they're doing something similar with Oliver Ivanovich. It really isn't painting a particularly good picture of what international influence can do to your justice system.
Indeed. How much of a constituency does Ivanovich have, though? Are people getting massively outraged on his behalf?
It's tricky, because Ivanovich was seen as very much someone who was trying to build up his own position in North Kosovo. While the internationals liked him because he spoke English and seemed reasonable, a lot of people on the ground would sort of roll their eyes a little in an affectionate way, but nonetheless they would say, well, that's Oliver. He really wanted to build up a position for himself as being the leader in North Kosovo. And I don't don't know if there's as sympathy for him as such, but I think certainly the justified questions, and if not outrage, about the fact that somebody can be held for 6 months without the hint of a charge being made.
Guy Delaunay in Serbia, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we will hear the first part of our summer murder mystery. Stay tuned to find out more. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Mash Ekut is a novel retail experience in a 100-year-old former train station in Tokyo. Monocle Films pays a visit to see how old infrastructure can be repurposed to improve urban life.
The shops at Mash Ekut tend to complement the building and each other. As with many of the customers, the businesses setting up here have been drawn by its unusual interiors and historical details. The result is a space where customers can come across a diverse variety of products, all of which form a unified whole.
Retail on the Rails, now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's coming up for 1841 here in London. Now, Monocle's summer newspaper, Mediterraneo, is on a newsstand near you right now. And among the many highlights contained therein is a murder mystery by Anne Zarudi, author of the Hermes Diactoros series of detective novels. You will find it on page 33, and here is the first chapter.
Murder Mystery in the Isles by Anne Zarudi. In a house on a Greek island, a man lies seriously ill in bed, tended to by his aunt. Meanwhile, a mysterious man arrives in town to visit an ancient shrine and drink the spring waters. But the water has stopped flowing, and soon the man's investigations reveal that there are turbulent depths beneath the island's calm surface.
"I brought you these," said the shepherd. He laid two birds on the table, partridges limp in death, strung together with twine around their necks. There was blood on the birds' feathers where the pellets had hit. I shot them myself this morning. He carried the scent of the mountains on his clothes, and his breath stank of the ouzo he'd been drinking. His dog, a skinny pointer, had followed him into the kitchen and was sniffing at the dirty saucer where the cats ate. "Sit down, Calais," said Chrysanthe. "Can I get you something to drink?" The shepherd pulled out a chair from under the table. The cane seat was frayed and a leg strut was missing. Cautiously, he sat. "Thank you," he said. "A nip of ouzo if you have it." "I don't keep spirits in this house," said Chrysanthe. At the stone sink, she filled a tumbler with water from an enamel jug and set it before the shepherd along with a bowl of purple figs. "Pure well water," she said, "and God's gift." She poured water into the cat's saucer for the panting dog. The shepherd split a fig open with his thumbs, inspecting its red innards for crawling things before biting into it. He chewed and swallowed. "You can make good raki from figs," he said. "My father kept a still. He reckoned figs were better than grape skins." Overhead, bed springs creaked. Chrysanthe glanced anxiously up at the ceiling. "How's your nephew?" asked the shepherd. Chrysanthe shook her head. "No better," she said. 4 days now. He can't keep anything down and the pain he's in." She made several practice crosses over her heart. "Why isn't he in hospital? 4 days and no improvement? You should be sending him there." "The doctor said there's no need. Bottled water and dry bread," he said, "and let the sickness work its way through." "I told him well water would be better. I've drunk water from that well all of my 70 years, and look at me." The shepherd did so, seeing sallow skin and liver spots and the old woman's last vain efforts at femininity, a pink slide pinning up her oily hair, and a pair of yellow slippers at odds with her widow's black. "He brought me water from the spring at St. Marina." She pointed to a row of blue-labelled bottles by the door. They're putting it in those fancy bottles now and charging money for it. I told him I should go into business with my well water. That's the church for you, said the shepherd, filling bottles to fill its own pockets. I've done as he says, Chrysanthe went on. He's the doctor, after all. But it's doing Geekus no good. The only thing that helps him is the painkillers. What does the doctor say it is? Maybe something he ate, but I've picked dandelions and chamomile and they'll help. The shepherd looked over the bunches of herbs at the centre of the table, then reached out to pinch off a flower of white-petaled chamomile. He sniffed it, pulled a face, and then tossed the flower away. That's stinking chamomile, not sweet, he said. That'll make him sicker. If my sheep get hold of that, I've known it'd kill them. I picked it in the same place I always pick it, said Chrysanthe. I boil it with the dandelions to make him tea. But if the doctor said only water... Chrysanthe began to unpick the knotted string around a partridge's neck. In the bedroom above, a floorboard creaked. This bird's old, she said. It'll be tough eating. Don't think I shall pay what I gave you last time. The shepherd split open another fig and hooked out a tiny white worm before taking a bite. I hear this house is up for sale, he said. I'd buy it myself if I had the money. How much is he asking for it? Chrysanthe looked up from the knot. What do you mean? This house isn't for sale. Yes, it is, said the shepherd. I heard Geekus talking about it a few days ago, how much money he's going to make off some Italians. He said... Under a hesitant footfall, the floorboards creaked again. The dog growled and the shepherd nudged it with his foot to make it quiet, but the animal moved to the foot of the stairs, baring its teeth. At the head of the stairs, a man appeared, wearing only his underwear. One hand was pressed against his stomach, with the other he held onto the wall to keep himself upright. His face was flushed and damp with fever, and blood had dried on his lower lip where he'd bitten it in his pain. The shepherd got hold of his dog and stood looking up at Geekus, shocked at the change in him. But Geekus didn't seem to see him.
Aunt, he said, get the doctor.
Chrysanthe jumped to her feet. To bed, she said, back into bed. She clutched the shepherd's arm as she passed him to go upstairs. Fetch the doctor, Calais, she murmured, quick as you can.
Of course, said the shepherd,
watching her guide her nephew back to the bedroom.
But I think you might do better with a priest.
Murder Mystery in the Isles was performed by Karen Cogan and written by Anne Zarudi. It's an original drama produced for Monocle 24 by Paul Noble.
We'll be bringing you the rest of that in instalments over the rest of this week on Midori House, or you can read the whole thing right now by purchasing Mediterraneo Monocle's summer newspaper on sale now. It is now time now for a tune on Midori House. We shall shortly be heading to New York, and indeed part of New York to which we will be heading is the Lower East Side. So here is a song about exactly that district. It's the Magnetic Fields. A rare permissible use of the ukulele in modern popular song there. That was the Magnetic Fields with Luckiest Guy on the Lower East Side from their album 69 Love Songs. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the world of television, cinema, theatre, books, etc. And today we're joined by Shana Beth Mason, New York-based art critic, to discuss the latest exhibitions in New York. Shana, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to start with the Erexu exhibition at the Hasted Kreutler Gallery. About two words of those five, I suspect I've mispronounced. tell us a bit about this exhibition. What can we look forward to from this one?
This exhibition comes from Awal Erescu. He's a 26-year-old, newly minted Yale Master of Fine Arts graduate. He was born in Ethiopia. And the work kind of toys with the boundaries between aesthetic cliches and these sensitive explorations of African-American metaphors. And there's also concerns with the millennial generation. A couple of my highlights include a very wry riff on Donald Judd's stacked prefabricated works. Erescu's version of this is in the form of a tower of basketball hoops, and their nets are actually made out of gold chains. And other included works are primitive-esque African masks that are mounted high on thin iron poles. There's a photograph, a particularly striking photograph, of a young woman in a gold lamé swimsuit, and she stands on a rocky shore positioned as a so-called Black Venus. And what struck me about that was her hair. Her hair is almost the shade of red dye that's almost suited to rebellious teenagers or underground rock stars.
It is an extraordinary and striking photo. I did especially like, I haven't seen the exhibition, of course, just the images on the website. I did especially like the basketball hoops. Where do you think he's going with those?
I would imagine that, like I said, you know, it's kind of a take on Donald Judd's prefabricated stacked works or these industrial types of conceptual art. And Erescu does make note of these particular leanings. I think that it's also the African-American penchant for basketball culture and the gold chains also representative of a certain lifestyle or an aspirational lifestyle. So there's a number of things at work in this piece, and it's the title, which is quite inappropriate. the title is actually pulled from a Jay-Z lyric, and again playing on, you know, aspirations of what a young Black man could be, should be, might be.
Okay, well, that's Awal Erescu's exhibition, The Only Way Is Up. That's at the Hasted Kreutler Gallery in Chelsea until August 15th. Staying in Chelsea, this time at the Casey Kaplan Gallery, the Never Look Back When Leaving exhibition.
Yes, this is, there are two artists that I've chosen from this particular exhibition. The exhibition itself features all 23 artists from the gallery's roster. It's the gallery's final show in the Chelsea space before they move to Manhattan in the Flower District this coming January. But two of the artists that I loved particularly in the show were Matthew Brannan and Sonia Kantarovsky. Brannan's work is called Priorities, and it kind of gently pokes at the hipster culture's obsession with Proust, Marcel Proust. And he whittles this sort of fetish down to photorealist renderings of his most prominent works, and it's arranged as if it's on a bookshelf, you know, set against a very blank canvas. And Kantarovsky's, he has these flamboyant cartoon-like paintings, and they are unapologetically funny. They tend to satirize notions of seriousness, quote-unquote, of contemporary or conceptual art. And this particular painting, which is untitled, is apparently the, you know, the tortured genius slumped dramatically over his desk.
I'm glad you also thought it was funny, because my instinctive reaction at seeing it was genuine laughter, and I mean laughter with it rather than at it. It is, it does seem to capture a man in the jest of doing something theatrical while absolutely no one's paying any attention to him.
And I think that's never the artist's concern, whether attention is paid. He has other forms of works that absolutely, you know, demolish in the best possible way, you know, images of Matisse and Van Gogh. And he, again, he makes no apologies for his cartoon-like characters. And I'm sure that he wouldn't shy away from the term, because, again, it is a pantomime. It's a caricature of a certain trope.
Okay, and just finally, before we go, this is, sorry, I should say the Never Look Back When Leaving exhibitions at the Casey Kaplan Gallery till August the 1st. But you wanted to talk as well about the forthcoming Adam Schechter exhibition at 11 Rivington.
Yes, this gallery is posited in the very active Lower East Side sector. And what I love about Adam Schechter is that his digital video animation, these works are very suspicious, they're very confusing, and they're very wonderful. The short films, they have these haunting ambient soundtracks, and they're set against crudely drawn figures that look as if they're in a frenetic motion. And these are very subversive gestures, undermining common attitudes towards what contemporary art should look like or might sound like. I felt it was more of a crazy hybrid of these melancholy characters jumping out of a Nickelodeon program from the 1990s, something I used to see when I was a kid. And again, it has this, you know, very disturbed or distorted nostalgia to it.
And that will be at 11 Rivington from September the 2nd. Shana Beth Mason, New York-based art critic, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests earlier in the show, Xenia Wickett and Ivor Gaber. Today's show was produced by Isabel Kaiser, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lucy Atkinson, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Coming up after the headlines is Culture with Robert Bound at 2200, The Monocle Daily. And this show returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.